From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how the Betsy DeVos Department of Education halted investigations into why African-American students in Texas are four times more likely to be harshly punished in schools than white students. Texans can save money this weekend as they prepare for the next disastrous extreme weather event. And the biggest little race in Texas, the 0.5K that everyone is talking about. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It's called the school-to-prison pipeline. That's what studies have identified as a pattern of action by school districts, administrators, and security personnel who send students into the juvenile criminal justice system for infractions that used to be handled in the principal's office. Dress code violations, tardiness, horseplay, talking back for some students means going to a courtroom, seeing a judge, spending days and nights incarcerated. But which students? Multiple studies have identified that it's much more likely to be students of color. That's the pattern at Bryan ISD in Brazos County. And for years, under the Obama administration's Department of Education, the federal government has been investigating Bryan ISD and other school districts for racial bias in discipline. They found that black students are four times more likely to be suspended from school than white students and twice as likely to be arrested. But under the Trump administration, with controversial Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos, many of those investigations have been dropped with no recommendations for reforms, including the investigation into Bryan ISD. Annie Waldman writes about this for ProPublica in the story, "Shutdown of Texas Schools Probe Shows Trump Administration Pullback on Civil Rights."
All you have to do is really look at the data on school discipline in Bryan and also across the country to see that the stats are disproportionately, unfortunately, black students bear the brunt of school discipline. So, for example, if you look in Bryan, black students are almost four times as likely to be suspended or referred to a disciplinary school as their white peers. And if you look at, whether, for example, arrests in school, black students also account for 60% of the arrests in Bryan, Texas, whereas they only account for 20% of enrollment. So when you see, and across the country, you see numbers like this as well. So when you see these disproportionate figures, you know, it's important to ask the question, why is this happening? Especially as research shows, black students aren't more likely to act out or misbehave than students of other races. So really, you have to think, is it implicit bias? Are there other things going on? Or could it just be the school discipline system that we have?
Now, do we know that there are students who are white who do the exact same thing as students who are African-American, and yet the white student may have to deal with a tisk-tisk and go back to your seat, but a black student is going to have to be disciplined and maybe end up in the juvenile facility?
Right. So actually, federal civil rights investigators during the probe of Bryan schools found 10 incidents where black students received harsher punishment than white students for the same conduct. And when we looked at this, you know, one example is that one student, for example, would receive one day of in-school suspension for, you know, something like failure to follow directives or defiance. And a white student would receive detention or 1 hour detention instead. So when you see that the same misconduct is happening and they have different discipline for that misconduct, it really makes you wonder, what is, you know, how are they distributing this discipline? Are they really, you know, treating all students the same, or is something else going on?
So we're talking about what kind of, you talk about defiance. I don't know what that would be, how you would define it. So this is not just fighting or doing other things that are destructive, vandalism. We're talking about basic behavior, things that kids experiment with all the time to figure out what are the social norms.
Right, exactly. Like, you might see sometimes offenses such as disruptive behavior, failure to follow directives. You know, of course, there are some offenses that relate to fighting, but that's not all of them. You know, sometimes it's just obscene language that a student might get suspended for or, you know, sent to detention for.
What about things like tardiness?
Yeah, I have heard that there have been some cases related to that. I think that, you know, it's really at the school's discretion how they interpret their code, their manual, right, their code of laws. Each school is able to come up with, you know, what they think is right and wrong and what kind of discipline they're able to mete out because of when kids cross those boundaries. So sometimes it's kind of discretionary for the teacher who's making those decisions.
But the schools say they have zero tolerance for any misbehavior, and it's for sometimes for security purposes. You know, they have to crack down on kids to make sure that they toe the line and have in classroom discipline.
Right, right. I mean, and this really was born out of the 1980s when, you know, it was an era of the drug war and so-called super predators, and many school districts were really afraid of juvenile crime increasing in the schools, and so they began to bolster their approach to school discipline. And one way of doing this was setting up these quote-unquote zero-tolerance policies, which were essentially mandated harsh punishments for certain misconduct. But then when you look at the civil rights investigations that the federal government did across the country, they found numerous instances of similar offenses and unequal discipline, which led them to believe that there's something else going on, that zero tolerance policies might be actually still handled disproportionately when it comes to Black students versus students of other races.
So we're talking which grade levels?
We're talking all grade levels. I mean, if you look at the statistics, it's quite shocking because, you know, generally Black students are four times more likely to receive an out-of-school suspension, but we're not just talking about K through 12. Even preschool students are affected by this. In fact, across the country, Black preschool students are more than three times as likely as their white peers to be suspended from school.
What can a preschool child do that, and what kind of punishment would they get?
They might be suspended and sent out of school for something as simple as maybe, you know, fighting with another, you know, preschool student, but that's normal behavior for small children. They're still learning the rules. They're still learning what's socially acceptable. And what this really says to me is, you know, are there other ways that we could be handling discipline in the school? Are there more restorative justice techniques that might bring in both families, bring in the whole community to understand what's really happening with this child? Are there behavioral, you know, approaches that we could be using that could be best for the child to set them up later down the line? I mean, you know, what happens with school discipline is that children start to internalize this, the kind of effect of discipline inside. What happens is that they start to criminalize themselves and see themselves as a criminal. It's a theory called labeling theory. And what happens when kids start to criminalize themselves, they act out more. And because they're acting out more, that just escalates the entire situation until their peers start to see them like that as well. And this is how implicit bias is created and reinforced in our schools.
So we're talking about established science, looking at data. This is not anecdotal evidence. We're able to show that African American students are going to face harsher penalty, more likely to be penalized, sometimes to a point where they are put into juvenile facilities and taken out of the classroom suspended, where for an instance that for something that a white student would not have to face those penalties.
Right, right. And, you know, under the Obama administration, Obama actually personally saw the school-to-prison pipeline as a top priority. He really saw this as, you know, one of the leading causes for our enormous criminal justice complex in our society. And so what he wanted to do was kind of look at these investigations and look at these situations systemically and say, how can we tackle this problem in a much larger way so we're not just putting a Band-Aid on the situation? And so they brought in a lot of these civil rights investigations. They threw a lot of resources into them, but they took a lot of time to do these long probes. I mean, the Bryan investigation was started in 2013, and it wasn't until last year that it was finally closed, with no findings, of course. So, you know, these investigations take a long time, and when DeVos came in, you know, she did say that she wanted to close some of these investigations just to kind of keep the ball rolling, you know, have more time to investigate certain things and more and give her, you know, investigators more room to take on other projects. But what happens is that, you know, that creates a sense of unequal justice for families, especially, you know, for families like those in Bryan, who they, you know, there were some people who were waiting to see if there would be justice and maybe that there were reforms that were going to be made.
So who is the person that deals out these punishments? Is it going to be the teacher, or is it going to be, because a lot of schools have these security officers that are like a part of the sheriff's department or something that are working there?
Right. I mean, really, you know, back in the day, the punishments used to kind of be centered in the school administrator's office. But now, because there are school law enforcement and there's school resource officers and there's security guards, there's a kind of a balance between police officers taking some of the cases and the school administrators taking some of them as well. Oftentimes, they work in collaboration. And so what you see is that sometimes teachers don't want to handle situations, maybe because they're afraid of litigation or because they don't want to get hurt or whatever. And so they'll bring in the police officer, and it will really escalate the situation where it increases the student's chance of going to jail or getting suspended or having some kind of interaction with law enforcement.
Schools are basically a microcosm of an entire society.
Mm-hmm. And I would agree with that.
And so when we see this uneven justice happening here, this is what's happening all across in our streets.
Right. I mean, it's kind of what people don't think about is that, you know, racism, there's overt racism, right? There's overt bias where, you know, it's what we saw with, you know, clear policies that segregated the schools. But, you know, even though that does still exist today, we don't see it as much. And instead, what we see is unconscious bias or implicit bias. You know, certain policies that might on their face seem neutral, but in the way that they play out, they can still be very discriminatory towards people of color. And that's what we're starting to see, and, you know, people are starting to talk about more in the schools, is how does this kind of system of, you know, disparate impact and disparate treatment of people of color kind of play out. And, you know, this happens everywhere in our society, whether it's schools, housing, you know, the criminal justice system, prisons, jails. I mean, it's impossible to ignore this.
And we have a society which sees adolescent black males as full-grown man, and they will treat him like that, even though it's still a child.
Right, right. I mean, the young woman that I profiled in my investigation, she's a seventh grader. She's 13 years old. And yes, she was horse playing in school, and, you know, it ended up in an accident. But, you know, she was jailed for an accident in art class and sent to jail for 3 days and then sent into a disciplinary school for weeks. You know, she's 13 years old. I mean, she's a child who's still kind of learning what's right and wrong. You know, we have to start thinking less that these are, you know, adults that we need to, like, give them hard discipline and think about, you know, these are children. Is this how we want to raise children in our country?
So we know we have this problem, and it's issues of bias, and it's part of our system that we have. And we had the Obama administration was trying to figure out a way, how do we find some solutions? Is it training? What can we do to recognize the problem and figure out a way to de-escalate this? But now we have Donald Trump in the White House, we have a different kind of Department of Education. What's happening?
Yeah, so when Betsy DeVos came in, she made it very clear that, you know, she was going to pull back some of the regulations that had been put in place during the Obama administration. Specifically, one of the big approaches that she's scaling back is that of doing these large systemic civil rights investigations. In fact, since, you know, she has come in, there have been over 50 school discipline cases which have been closed because of, you know, insufficient evidence when it's questionable whether there actually was evidence or not. And there have been hundreds and hundreds of cases, if not thousands, of complaints which have been closed over the past 6 months, year. And it's unclear, really. You know, a lot of this is not transparent. Unless you're filing public records requests like I am, you know, you're not going to see how many investigations are being closed day in and day out.
And this has an impact on the outcomes that we have in our schools with children. We want to educate. We want them to graduate. And we want them to go on and become productive members of society. This impacts that.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about impact, I think about what would have happened in the Bryan School's investigation had the civil rights investigators actually gotten a settlement. I mean, what's crazy is that, you know, I filed a public records request with the school district, and I actually found that they were in the process of negotiating agreement that would have been settled, and they would have been put in place over a dozen reforms. And the reforms that they were going to put in place in the Bryan schools were, you know, reforming their disciplinary policies, creating additional support services for punished students like mentoring, designating a campus behavior coordinator, and also educating parents on how to file complaints related to discipline and conducting annual school reviews. You know, these are all reforms that might have, you know, made the school discipline climate a lot better for students, made it a little more fair, made it a little more transparent. But because this investigation was closed, you know, these reforms are not necessarily going to go into play.
Annie Waldman is a reporter at ProPublica covering education. She wrote the story, Shutdown of Texas Schools Probe Shows Trump Administration Pullback on Civil Rights. Hurricane season begins on June 1st, and if this year's spell of storms is anything like last year's, Texans need to gear up. This weekend is an opportunity to stock up on emergency supplies like batteries, first aid kits, ice chests, and hatchets. These items and more can be purchased tax-free across Texas. Kevin Lyons is a spokesperson for the Texas Comptroller's Office.
This is the first of three that we have each year. The sales tax holiday for emergency supplies, which is from April 28th to April 30th. So that's Saturday at 12:01 a.m. till Monday at midnight. We also have the energy efficient and water efficient sales tax holiday, which is next month. And, of course, the big one, which is the back-to-school sales tax holiday, which is in August. But this one is, there's sort of three price points. Again, this is, you know, this is the kind of time of year when you've got some folks facing severe weather. In Central Texas, you've got a lot of flooding. In South Texas, we saw with the hurricane last year. In North Texas, there seems like there's a tornado every other weekend. So this is the perfect time of year to be thinking about those kind of items that you can buy before an emergency situation occurs.
You have a very precise list of what people can buy. And what kind of items are on that?
Sure, sure. So first of all, let your listeners know that you can go to our website for a complete list at comptroller.texas.gov. There's a list of emergency preparation supplies that you can download, and you can take it to the store with you and be able to get the correct items. But we can talk about the kinds of items and sort of three price points. So there are items that are priced less than $3,000, and really there's only one item there, and that's the portable generators. And then we've got a price point of items priced less than $300. Things like hurricane shutters and emergency ladders will get you qualify for tax exempt status. And then some of the most popular items are the ones priced less than $75. And those are items such as batteries, fuel containers, flashlights, those kinds of things. We've done some math on this, and we expect Texas shoppers to save about $1.5 million in state and local sales taxes during the tax holiday.
Now, when you pay sales tax, typically there is a local city sales tax involved. Is that also waived?
Correct. Yeah. Absolutely. All the taxes waived on the qualifying items.
I was wondering, if you go in there and you buy it and they charge you tax, what do you tell them?
That's a good question, yes. This is the newer of the three sales tax holidays we have, and so we've let all the vendors know about this holiday, but obviously there's some vendors that may not know about it and may charge it tax anyway. If that happens, again, you can come to our website at comptroller.texas.gov, and there's some forms you can fill out to get a tax rebate. So you obviously fill out the form, you provide your receipt, and the comptroller's office would reimburse you for the tax you paid on that particular item.
Well, what's interesting about this is, of course, there's opportunity for people to save a dollar, and that's always good, but help bring some attention to the fact that hurricane season is just around the corner, June 1st. We got to get ready.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's never too early to purchase those kinds of items that can prepare you for those disasters. And so this weekend is a perfect time to do that. And like I said, we've got a lot of items on the list that you can look at and see what's tax exempt.
And so there's a list here of things that are not exempt for people who are not completely clear about that. But, you know, things like camping equipment
exactly. Tend
not to be part
camping
of
stoves, camping supplies,
tents,
chainsaws, plywood, extension ladders, step ladders, tents, batteries are exempt, but not batteries for automobiles or boats or other motorized vehicles. And again, they can come to our website at comptroller.texas.gov, and it'll give them a good list of what is and what is not qualified for the tax exemption.
So people can save about, what, 8%?
8.25% is kind of the average, you know, again, with the state sales tax being at 6.25%, and then the local taxing entities having a right to add another 2 cents to it. So about 8 to 8.25% is about the average per, you know, savings that people will get.
And even though this is a statewide sales tax holiday, there are many people who don't live on the coast, are not in some of these extreme weather type areas, but they're still, you know, you never know when you're going to have a wildfire or something.
Exactly. Yeah, you just, again, and this applies to everybody in Texas. So this is the weekend. It applies to all the purchases you make the items that qualify for the tax exemption.
Kevin Lyons is a spokesperson for the Texas Comptroller's Office. This weekend is a statewide tax-free holiday for emergency preparedness items. A common way to raise money for a good cause is to hold a 5K race. There's one almost every weekend in most Texas metro areas. But let's face it, not everyone is jazzed about having to run the 3.1 miles of a 5K, so on May the 5th in Bernie in the Texas Hill Country, they're holding a 0.5K. Jay Milton is the organizer.
I prefer to call myself the czar, but I'm the guy kind of putting the thing together.
0.5K, why is this so long?
That's a great question. Next year we'll have to consider shortening it up because it is, that is a pretty hefty distance.
Is this an original idea or did you steal this from someplace else?
No, of course it was stolen, right? I mean, all good ideas are stolen. I have a friend that lives out in the Denver area, and a few years ago he showed me a, I don't remember if it was a Facebook event or what it was, but there's a pub out in this suburb or near this suburb where they live, and they did a 0.5K. So I just had always thought it was really funny, a great idea for raising money, and took it to my friends, and we met a few times over beers and just came up with some really funny, stupid things to add to their event, and here we are.
So you took the idea and you ran with it, but just not very far.
Exactly. Right. Less than 0.5K, I can tell you that much for sure.
0.5K is
546 yards. So it's about a little more than one lap around a running track.
This is for a good cause.
Oh, it's for a great cause. Yeah, when we got together we wanted to do something like this, we weren't even really sure what charity we're going to raise money for. So we all just kind of threw it out there. We had three criteria. We knew that we wanted it to be small, where the money that we're going to raise would be, would be significant to the organization. We wanted it to be local to here in Bernie, and then we wanted it to focus on kids. So the organization that we're raising money for is called Blessings in a Backpack, and they basically help feed needy kids over the weekend. It's a great organization. Here in Bernie, it's 100% volunteers, and they self-fund themselves. So it's the money that we're raising for them is going to be a nice little chunk in their annual budget.
So you went to Blessings in a Backpack, and they provide food for the weekend for underprivileged children. And you told them, we're going to do a 0.5K for you. And what was their reaction?
I think the reaction was sort of the same as everybody else's, which was, they kind of looked at me kind of sideways, like, say that again? And then once the idea set in and they kind of were like, oh, I see, I get it, that's funny. Then they were really happy. It's a great, no effort on their part. We're just raising the money and handing them a check at the end, and it's gonna be a significant part of their annual budget.
So the event is sold out.
It is. Yeah, we had originally set a goal of 100 people, and I even thought that was maybe a stretch. The reaction to it has just been really fantastic, both from the registration part of it and the sponsors that we've had. And we have a couple of our primary sponsors are a couple of small local brew pubs here in Bernie, the Dodging Duck and the Cibolo Creek Brewing Company. And they're moderate sized places, but they wouldn't be able to handle a crowd of 500 people on a Saturday. So we just ultimately had to limit registrations because we didn't want either of those two places to be overwhelmed. And, we want to make this a memorable event for everybody so we can do it again next year. Last thing we want is for people to be mad because they can't get their beer. That could lead to a riot, and that wouldn't be good.
When the people who do complete it, they get all of the normal swag that you would get at one of these running events.
That's right. Yeah. A T-shirt. Everybody at this race, however, gets a medal because, everybody's a winner in this race. And we want, we're all about self-esteem and making sure that everybody feels good about themselves. So everybody's going to get a medal and a T-shirt. And then also get one of those, you know, those sort of pretentious oval stickers that people have on the back of their windshield or on their back windshield. Everybody's going to get a 0.5K oval sticker that they can put on the back of their car so that they can, you know, basically communicate to the rest of the world that there's a real athlete driving that car right now.
So they can lord it over us mere mortals that they managed to do the distance of 0.5K. And so there will be like first aid stations along the way and things like that.
Correct. Yeah, we have a about halfway down the quote unquote run is there's going to be a coffee and donut station where, you know, just in case people feel like they need a few more carbs to get to the finish line, they'll be able to down a couple of donut holes and do a quick shot of coffee and then keep going. And then next to that, that's also where the designated smoking area is, too, in case anybody needs to, you know, have a quick cig before they head down the rest of the path. And then we're going to have a medical tent that we're going to have set up there that may or may not be staffed. We'll see. But, you know, 500 yards can be pretty significant, and we don't want to take any chances.
We know that when you have money in this world that you get certain benefits, and so that's also evident in this race.
Right. Yes. We have a VIP option, which lets people basically buy their way out of even participating in the race. So for an extra $25, not only, well, you don't even have to run the event. We have a shuttle that will take the VIPs from the Dodging Duck, which is our starting brew pub, down to Cibolo Creek brew pub. So they don't even have to do the run or walk. Plus, the VIPs also get a bigger medal than everybody else because, by definition, they're more important and should be able to, you know, buy the finer things in life.
There is a supervisory organization of this, I understand.
Yes, yeah, we were very fortunate to get Slacker to sanction the race. That's the Society for Lazy and Carefree Runners, and so they've sanctioned the race and officially measured the distance to make sure that it is exactly 0.5K plus or minus about 0.5K. So, yeah, that's been a real help to our registrations for sure.
Are you concerned about other people stealing your idea that this is you stole it first, but you seem to have done a lot with it? What happens if suddenly there's so many of these 0.5K races and that you lose your novelty of having this thing?
Yeah, it's a real valid concern, and we've already talked about it. And maybe we'll go down to 0.49 or something, just to, you know, maintain our competitive advantage over all of the other people out there that want to steal the idea. I think it's, you know, it really has been kind of overwhelming, the response. It's been really just fantastic, and so if you know, other organizations steal the idea and use it and they can raise money with it, I think it's awesome. It's fantastic.
Jay Milton is the organizer of the 0.5K in Bernie, being held on May the 5th. It's raising money for Blessings in a Backpack. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs. And you can download us wherever you get those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.